Perhaps you work at a big organization. Perhaps you feel as though there's just too much resistance to change. Here's a question. Is your organization stiffer than the Pentagon? More bureaucratic or formalized? Thomas Barnett changed the Pentagon from the bottom. No, he wasn't on KP duty, but he was close. He had no status, no rank. He was just a researcher with a big idea. Here's what the Wall Street Journal said, quoting, Mr. Barnett overhauled the concept to address more directly the post-9/11 world. The result is a 3-hour PowerPoint presentation that more resembles performance art than a Pentagon briefing. It's making Mr. Barnett, 41 years old, a key figure in the debate currently raging about what the modern military should look like. Senior military officials say his decidedly controversial ideas are influencing the way the Pentagon views its enemies, vulnerabilities, and future structure. Unquote. It's simple, really. Barnett led a tribe that was passionate about change. He galvanized them, inspired them, and connected them through his idea. One man with no authority suddenly becomes a key figure. Tribes give each of us the very same opportunity. Skill and attitude are essential. Authority is not. In fact, authority can get in the way. The Grateful Dead and Jack. It's worth taking a second to think about what it really means to be in a tribe. In Permission Marketing, years ago, I wrote about how marketers must earn the right to deliver anticipated, personal, and relevant messages to people who want to get them. And that's still correct, as far as it goes. But tribes go much further. That's because in addition to the messages that go from the marketer or the leader to the tribe, there are the messages that go sideways, from member to member, and back to the leader as well. The Grateful Dead understood this. They created concerts to allow people not just to hear their music, but to hear it together. That's where the tribe part comes in. I just heard about Jack, an occasional restaurant run by Danielle Sucher and Dave Turner in Brooklyn. They open the restaurant only about 20 times a year, on Saturday nights, by appointment. Go online and you can see the menu in advance. Then you book and pay if you want to go. Instead of seeking diners for their dishes, Danielle and Dave get to create dishes for their diners. Instead of serving anonymous patrons, they throw a party. Danielle is the food columnist for the popular Gothamist website, and she and Dave run the food blog Habeas Brulee. That means they already interact with the tribe. It means that once the restaurant is up and running, it becomes the central clearinghouse, the place to hang out with the other tribe members. If the food is daring and the service is generous, Jack can't fail. The market requires change, and that requires leadership. If leadership is the ability to create change your tribe believes in, and the market demands change, then the market demands leaders. Managers manage by using the authority the factory gives them. You listen to your manager or you lose your job. A manager can't make change because that's not his job. His job is to complete tasks assigned to him by someone else in the factory. Leaders, on the other hand, don't care very much for the organizational structure or the official blessing of whatever factory they work for. They use passion and ideas to lead people, as opposed to using threats and bureaucracy to manage them. Leaders must become aware of how the organization works, because this awareness allows them to change it. Leadership doesn't always start at the top, but it always manages to affect the folks at the top. In fact, most organizations are waiting for someone like you to lead them. What does it take to create a movement? If we look at two Nobel Prize winners and their movements, Muhammad Yunus and Al Gore, some parallels become clear, and they directly relate to the tactics available to you as you lead your tribe. Microfinance as a tool to fight poverty and the effort to recognize and stem global warming have both become movements. But as Yasmina Zaidman at the Acumen Fund told me, both problems and their solutions were recognized more than 30 years ago. We weren't lacking the answer. Muhammad Yunus had it all along. So why did it take 30 years for the idea to gain steam? The answer, as you've probably guessed, is that there's a difference between telling people what to do and inciting a movement. The movement happens when people talk to one another, when ideas spread within the community, and most of all, when peer support leads people to do what they always knew was the right thing. Great leaders create movements by empowering the tribe to communicate. They establish the foundation for people to make connections, as opposed to commanding people to follow them. This is how Skype spread around the world. Co-founder Niklas Zennström understood that overthrowing the tyranny of the phone companies was too big a project for a small company. But if he could empower the tribe to do it themselves, to connect to one another, and to spread the word, he would be able to incite a movement. Malcolm Gladwell wrote about the fall of the Berlin Wall, and it involved much the same dynamic. The collapse of East Germany wasn't the work of one hard-working activist. Instead, it was the gradual but inexorable growth of the tribe, a loosely coordinated movement of activists that gained in force until it couldn't be stopped. One after another, intractable problems fall in the face of movements. Improving a tribe. As we saw earlier, it takes only two things to turn a group of people into a tribe: a shared interest and a way to communicate. The communication can be one of four kinds: leader to tribe, tribe to leader, tribe member to tribe member, or tribe member to outsider. So, a leader can help increase the effectiveness of the tribe and its members by, 1, transforming the shared interest into a passionate goal and desire for change, 2, providing tools to allow members to tighten their communications, and 3, leveraging the tribe to allow it to grow and gain new members. Most leaders focus only on the third tactic. A bigger tribe somehow equals a better tribe. In fact, the first two tactics almost always lead to more impact. Every action you take as a leader can affect these three elements, and the challenge is to figure out which one to maximize. The American Automobile Association has millions of members, but it arguably has far less impact on the world than do the 2,000 people who go to the TED conference each year. One is about big, and the other is about change. The National Rifle Association has a huge impact on the political culture of the United States, far in excess of the organization's actual size. That's because the tribe is extraordinarily well connected, communicating up, down, and sideways, and because they have a passionate mission, not just a common idea. The new tools and technologies available to groups are transforming what it means to think of tribal communication. Smart leaders are grabbing those tools and putting them to work. What tribes leave behind? Build a company and you'll leave a trace. A factory, advertising, the non-recyclable junk produced as a result of your efforts. thinking about stuff is easy because we can see and touch and hold stuff. Stuff seems to matter because it's here, right now. Tribes, though, aren't about stuff. They're about connection. One of my favorite organizations, the Acumen Fund, just celebrated its 7th anniversary. This nonprofit funds entrepreneurs in the developing world using trade and ownership and commerce as a replacement for achievement-stifling aid. Acumen makes connections. It is growing a tribe of committed, talented people who are spreading a message of empowerment, respect, and growth. Here's what amazed me, though. Unlike the residue of stuff, the tribal connections you can create with leadership grow. They don't fade. As the organization matures and touches more people, those connections lead to more connections. The tribe thrives. It delivers value and it spreads. Internet folks call this viral activity or a virtuous cycle. The better you do, the better you do. Connections lead to connections. Great ideas spread. Anatomy of a movement. Senator Bill Bradley defines a movement as having three elements. One, a narrative that tells a story about who we are and the future we're trying to build. Two, a connection between and among the leader and the tribe. Three, something to do. The fewer limits, the better. Too often, organizations fail to do anything but the third. Wikipedia. How did Wikipedia become one of the top 10 sites on the internet? It has only about a dozen full-time employees and had no source of revenue other than small donations. The way that Jimmy Wales, Wikipedia's co-founder, built the tribe is instructive. He attracted a small group of people. Only 5,000 people account for the vast majority of work on the articles on the site, and engaged them in a vision. He didn't tell them what to do. He didn't manage the effort. He led it. Wales connected the tribe members to one another with ever-evolving technology that made it easier and easier for them to engage and communicate. And he gave the tribe a platform they could use to engage the outside world. That's it. Three steps. Motivate, connect, and leverage. Leading from the bottom. In 1984, at the age of 24, I joined a tiny software company called Spinnaker. Based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, we were crazy enough to embrace the audacious goal of inventing the first generation of educational computer games. I was the 30th employee. After my summer internship, Spinnaker offered me a job starting a new brand. They wanted me to acquire science fiction stories and turn them into literary adventure games. Byron Price had already sold us the rights to Fahrenheit 451 and a few other novels, and I had to acquire others and turn them all into products ready for stores nationwide. The problem was that no one worked for me. No secretary, no staff, no programmers. Spinnaker was busy building dozens of products, and about 40 programmers in the engineering department were allocated on a rotating basis to various projects. I was lent precisely 3 programmers. I needed more, a lot more, if I was going to make my Christmas ship date. So I started a newsletter. The newsletter highlighted the work of every person who worked on one of my products. It highlighted their breakthroughs and talked about the new ground we were breaking. Music in a game! I made photocopies and distributed the newsletter to the interoffice mailbox of every person in the company. By then, about 100 people. Twice a week, the newsletter went out. Twice a week, I talked about our quest. Twice a week, I chronicled the amazing work of our tiny tribe. The newsletter connected the tribe members. It turned a disparate group of career engineers into a working community. Within a month, six engineers had defected to the tribe, working with me in their spare time. Then it was 20. Soon, every person in the entire department was either assigned to my project or moonlighting on it. We shipped 5 products in time for Christmas, and every one went gold, selling millions of dollars worth of copies and saving the company. Did engineers switch because of the newsletter? Of course not. They switched for the journey. They wanted to be part of something that mattered. 20 years later, people on that team still talk about what we built. And I, the 24-year-old with no experience and no staff, got to go on the ride of a lifetime. Is that all I did? Launch a newsletter? Of course not. I did difficult things, pushed obstacles out of the way, lived and breathed the project, and injected it with a soul. 30 of us slept in the office every night for a month to make the ship date. 29 highly skilled technical people and me. Everyone had a job to do that month, and mine was to help everyone else communicate. Everything I did was for us, not for me. I didn't manage. I led. Crowds and tribes. 2 different things. A crowd is a tribe without a leader. A crowd is a tribe without communication. Most organizations spend their time marketing to the crowd. Smart organizations assemble the tribe. Crowds are interesting, and they can create all sorts of worthwhile artifacts and market effects. But tribes are longer lasting and more effective. Marketing changes everything, but it mostly changes the market. The market wants you to be remarkable. The most important tribes are bored with yesterday and demand tomorrow. Most of all, the market has demonstrated that ideas that spread win, and the ideas that are spreading are the remarkable ones. For 50 years, established brands with efficient factories and effective marketing carried the day. Pepsi, the Salvation Army, and the local hardware store were the cornerstones of the marketplace. Suddenly, though, the oldest brands are no longer the fastest growing ones. Suddenly, the most experienced business people are no longer the most successful ones. And suddenly, the safest jobs are not so safe anymore. The marketplace has raised its voice. It's now clear that we want novelty and style and, most of all, stuff that's great. If you want us to follow you, don't be boring. Good enough stopped being good enough a long time ago. So why not be great? The difference between average and mediocre. Management often works to maintain the status quo, to deliver average products to average people. In a stable environment, this is exactly the right strategy. Build reliability and predictability, cut costs, and make a profit. Traditional marketing, the marketing of push, understands this. The most stable thing to do is push a standard product to a standard audience and succeed with discounts or distribution. But for tribes, average can mean mediocre, not worth seeking out, boring. Life's too short to fight the forces of change. Life's too short to hate what you do all day. Life's way too short to make mediocre stuff. And almost everything that's standard is now viewed as mediocre. Is there a difference between average and mediocre? Not so much. Average stuff is taken for granted, not talked about, and certainly not sought out. The end result of this is that many people, many really good people, spend all day trying to defend what they do, trying to sell what they've always sold, and trying to prevent their organizations from being devoured by the forces of the new. It must be wearing them out. Defending mediocrity is exhausting. How many fans do you have? In an article posted on his Technium website, Kevin Kelly brilliantly described the world of 1,000 true fans. A true fan, he argues, is a member of the tribe who cares deeply about you and your work. That person will cross the street to buy from you, or bring a friend to hear you, or invest a little extra to support you. An individual artist needs only 1,000 true fans in her tribe. It's enough. It's enough because 1,000 fans will bring you enough attention and support to make a great living, to reach more people, to do great work. It's enough because 1,000 fans, true fans, form a tribe. A true fan brings 3 friends with him to a John Mayer concert or to the opening of a Chuck Close exhibit. A true fan pays extra to own the first edition or buys the hardcover instead of just browsing around on the website. Most important, a true fan connects with other true fans and amplifies the noise the artist makes. A corporation or a nonprofit or a church may need more than that. Perhaps 1 million fans if you're Starbucks, or 15 million if you're running for president. But it's beyond doubt that there is a number. You can figure out what it is, and it's probably fewer people than you imagine. Too many organizations care about numbers, not fans. They care about hits, or turnstile clicks, or media mentions. What they're missing is the depth of commitment and interconnection that true fans deliver. Instead of always being on the hunt for one more set of eyeballs, true leaders have figured out that the real win is in turning a casual fan into a true one. Fans, true fans, are hard to find and precious. Just a few can change everything. What they demand, though, is generosity and bravery. Twitter and trust and tribes and true fans. Most people who see Twitter.com don't get it. It seems invasive or time-consuming or even dumb. The converts, though, understand the true power of Twitter. Twitter is deceptively simple. It's a web protocol that makes it easy to instant message people with short notes like, going to the gym. In fact, the limit is 140 characters, about half the length of this paragraph. The difference between an instant message and twits, though, is that your instant message goes to one person and a twit goes to anyone who has chosen to follow you. Example. Laura Fitton, a young mom in Boston, has thousands of people following her on Twitter. Every time she types in a short blurb, they see it. Over time, twit by twit, Laura has built trust, which has led to a successful career as a consultant and a worldwide speaking practice. She's met fascinating people and changed the way her tribe sees the world. She now has true fans, people who seek her out and talk about her. Laura couldn't have done this with one speech or one blog post. But by consistently touching a tribe of people with generosity and insight, she's earned the right to lead. Personally, I can't imagine the technology mattering much. Blogs and Twitter and all manner of other tools will come and go, possibly by the time you listen to this. The tactics are irrelevant, and the technology will always be changing. The essential lesson is that every day it gets easier to tighten the relationship you have with the people who choose to follow you. The status quo. Organizations that destroy the status quo win. Individuals who push their organizations, who inspire other individuals to change the rules, thrive. Again, we're back to leadership, which can come from anyone, anywhere in the organization. Careful about what everyone knows. The status quo could be the time that everyone knows it takes you to ship an order, or the commission rate that everyone knows an agent ought to be paid. The status quo might be the way everyone expects a product to be packaged, or the pricing model that everyone accepts because it's been around so long. Whatever the status quo is, changing it gives you the opportunity to be remarkable. Initiative equals happiness. Look around. You'll see that the marketplace, every marketplace, rewards innovation, things that are fresh, stylish, remarkable, and new. The fastest growing churches are the newest ones. The best-selling books are always the surprise hits that come out of nowhere. The tax shelter that everyone is talking about is the one based on the latest rulings. Products and services like those require initiative to produce. You can't manage your way to initiative. Interesting side effect. Creating products and services that are remarkable is fun. Doing work that's fun is engaging. So not surprisingly, making things that are successful is a great way to spend your time. There you go. Initiative equals happiness. Crowbars. With a long enough crowbar, you can rip nails out of a board. With a long enough teeter-totter, you can lift a sumo wrestler off the ground. With enough leverage, you can change your company, your industry, and the world. The levers just got longer for everyone. The web and word of mouth and viruses and outsourcing and the long tail and the other factors involved in social media mean that everyone, every person, all 6 billion of us, has far more power than ever before. The king and the status quo are in big trouble. Wait. You might have glossed over what I just said, perhaps because it's so quick, but especially because it's so challenging. What I'm saying is that one person can make a video that reaches 50 million viewers. What I'm saying is that one person can invent a pricing model that turns an industry upside down. What I'm saying is that one person, okay, what I really mean is you, has everything. Everything you need to build something far bigger than yourself. The people around you realize this. And they are ready to follow if you're ready to lead. Scott Beal's Party. Here's a simple example of a tribe enabled by new technology. Scott Beal is an impresario with a long history of innovation and leadership. His company, Laughing Squid, does everything from web hosting to t-shirts, from laser engraving to arts listings. In short, he leads an eclectic tribe. At the South by Southwest conference in 2008, Scott got tired of waiting in line to get into the Google party. So he walked down the street, found a deserted bar, grabbed some tables in the back, and fired up his cell phone. Using Twitter, he announced, "Alta Vista party at Ginger Man." Within minutes, 8 people showed up. Shortly thereafter, 50. Then, there was a line out the door. No, it's not a political movement. Sure, it's a tribe. The energy and connection of the tribe are palpable. Multiply this effect by a million similar tribes, and now you understand what's happening. Tribes are just waiting to be turned into movements, and occasionally to stop to have a beer together. It's important to note that Twitter merely enabled the event. It didn't cause it to occur. Unless Scott had earned the respect and permission of the tribe that follows him, he would have been all alone at that bar. The party didn't take 4 minutes to organize. It took 4 years. A Brief History of the Factory, Part 1, The Beginning. 2 things conspired to bring us the factory. The first is pretty obvious. Factories are efficient. Starting a factory and filling it with factory workers is a good way to make a profit. By factory, I don't necessarily mean a place with heavy machinery, greasy floors, and a din. I mean any organization that cranks out a product or a service, does it with measurable output, and tries to reduce costs as it goes. I mean any job where your boss tells you what to do and how to do it. The second reason we have factories has nothing to do with efficiency and a lot to do with human nature. Part of us wants stability. We want the absence of responsibility that a factory job can give us. The idea of, I'm doing what you told me to do, is very compelling, especially if the alternative is foraging for food or begging on the street.